Hello everyone and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast, brought to you by Shoshin Works in collaboration with NASA Convergence Aeronautics Solutions Project. I'm your host, Marco Nunziata, economist turned innovation enthusiast. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping the fundamental frameworks within society, industry, the economy, policy, and they are reframing how we innovate and build for resilient futures. In this podcast series, brought to you by Shoshin Works in collaboration with NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solution Project, we are exploring these new ecosystemic models and impacts. And in today's episode in particular, we will be discussing things to look out for when planning for the future, and specifically the element of strategic surprise and how this approach has helped to solve problems. This is episode number 2 of our conversation with Mickey McManus. In the first episode, we focused on complexity, and now the focus switched to surprise. My co-host today instead is, no surprise, it's James Villarubia from NASA. Welcome, James.
Thanks, Marco. Hello, everyone. My name is James Villarubia. I'm currently a Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA, where I'm helping the engineers and the scientists there use AI to imagine and design better futures for humanity, which is, I think, pretty connected to a lot of this idea of strategic surprise. If anyone's been following the news around AI, we've had a lot of sort of surprising changes to the ecosystem, and how we deal with that and how we plan for that is sort of right at the forefront of our work today. So I'm really excited to continue this conversation with Mickey. Back to you, Marco.
And here we are with part 2 of this deep dive into human complexity and strategic surprise with Mickey McManus, currently senior advisor and executive leadership coach at Boston Consulting Group. Mickey, welcome back.
Hey, Marco. Hey, James. Good to see you both. I'm so happy to be here. And this topic of strategic surprise, I feel like I've become a student of this in the last 15 or 20 years. Back in 2001, I was asked to come in and be the CEO of this place that came out of Carnegie Mellon in 89 called Maya. And Maya stood for most advanced, yet acceptable. And it was trying to find that sweet spot between the most advanced technology, but acceptable for normal humans, not just hyper geeks who liked and nerded out on tech. And one of the things we did at Maya that I had never done before is we worked for this group called the Department of Strategic Surprise. And I had never heard of that before. And, you know, we brought to bear this interdisciplinary team, and we were this little company out of Carnegie Mellon. But we were helping take something that seemed impossible and try to move it from impossible to improbable, and ultimately maybe even inevitable. But the curious thing was, I was like, I'd never heard of the Department of Strategic Surprise before. And I don't know, Marco, had you heard before we talked about this, about the Department of Strategic Surprise?
I had not. It came as a welcome surprise to me. The very concept, I thought it was fantastic, but I'd never heard of it before.
So imagine you're like one of the biggest organizations in the world. You've just had this massive effort and you've succeeded. You're the CEO, you're in charge of this whole organization. And the world is applauding. Like, you are one of the best organizations in the world. You've really served your stakeholders well. Great. And then one day you hear this, and it's coming out of all your speakers. It's coming out of, like, you get out of your office and you run down the halls and you hear beeping. In fact, as you're looking at your whole company, organization across the globe, people are calling you and saying, what the heck is this beep? Well, it turns out that's actually what happened to the CEO or the commander-in-chief of the United States when, after World War II, and we got all these German rocket scientists, we got Wernher von Braun, we got, you know, who helped us create NASA and all the rest. Russia beat us to outer space with this cute little thing, actually twice, with a little propaganda campaign called Sputnik. And it's called the Sputnik Surprise. Because it flew over. And imagine you could do this great marketing campaign where everyone, all of your constituents, could tune a radio and hear your competitor beating you to outer space. Right? Just imagine. Everyone's doing it. So the president, he turns to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He turns to the members of Congress who deal with this, the era in the 50s. It was the Cold War. Did you know they were going to beat us to outer space and actually circle the globe? Like, actually build a man-made satellite? No, sir, that was a complete surprise. Okay, you know what I want? I want a Department of Strategic Surprise. And 3 months later, ARPA was born,
which was the Advanced Research Program Agency. And you might know it as DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research one. There's now an IARPA, which is an intelligence one. Actually, just last week at this beautiful conference on synthetic biology, I saw the head of HARPA, which is a brand new one focused on health. And it's about how do we surprise ourselves before we're surprised by our competitors? Or out in the world, how do we surprise ourselves before we're surprised by some existential threat? And I think a lot of people were surprised by generative AI in the last 3 months. But the curious thing is, and Marco and I, you know, both worked together at Autodesk for a few years there, and we were doing generative AI with NVIDIA, who yesterday apparently was just entered the $1 trillion company club for a few moments, 7 years ago, working on generative design and using agent-based and large language models and a whole bunch of other things that were early in research. 7 years ago. So it wasn't a surprise to everybody. And in fact, we were building products to actually say, how could you design bridges and buildings and cars with a team of machine learners to help you with human learners? But that was the whole idea of strategic surprise. So James said, you've heard about strategic surprise, you know, before this goofy story.
No, I think my only maybe framing was Rumsfeldian unknown unknowns. And sort of that was always my framing of like, have you thought about unknown unknowns and sort of that risk mitigation? But it's funny you bring up the sort of the generative AI because, you know, as a member of sort of that ecosystem, I was not surprised that it would happen. I was sort of delighted. It's like, oh, finally, we crossed the threshold of sort of human perception of like, people get it now. That you can put in a model and it feels convincing as opposed to like a machine was trying to convince you.
Yeah.
It's sort of like it passed the general Turing test. And that was, you know, not surprising to me. I was waiting for it to happen, but all my friends, all my peers, and the sort of the speed with which it took over the economy and the investor, you know, the VC space, that to me was surprising for sure.
It was sort of almost, you knew it was going to happen, but you didn't quite when it was going to happen. It was very hard to predict the emergent results, right? Because that's part of complex systems is emergence. We can't predict.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, someone's going to, you know, reach the light switch and turn it on. And like, you don't know what you're going to find, but like, it's got to happen. But I think it sort of speaks to one of the sort of the topics I'd like to hear your thoughts on is that it's not simply tech that is surprising here, that there's an ecosystem around that, around sort of the surprise might be how people respond to that tech and trying to think, particularly for like a large government institution or for a large company that has to deal with, you know, politics, international relations, sort of like in how they sort of deal with the world and sell their wares. How do you plan for that type of work? How do you approach strategic surprise? Like, what do you bring with you to work sort of mentally? And like, where do you start? By definition, can't know what's going to
happen. Yeah, you can't. Well, I think, so imagine that this original ARPA was created, and it helped us build this thing called the ARPANET, which we now call the internet. And it helped us with this challenge when Intel were the only wizards in the world who could put like about, at the top peak, they could put like 100,000 transistors on a chip. And that was a big deal. And ARPA said, let's create a very large scale integrated circuit initiative, a VLSI initiative, and make it so that an average company, this was their challenge. They framed it in a sentence. How can an average company use automation tools to put up to 1 trillion transistors on a chip, which only a few wizards in Intel could do? And of course, DARPA cared about this because if the wrong wizards got hit by a car or crashed in a plane, we'd lose like the capacity in the United States to actually make advanced computational chips. Now we have things like NVIDIA and AMD and other things and chipless fabs and stuff. That all came out of this challenge from ARPA, from DARPA, to say, could an average company use automation to put 1 trillion chips, 1 trillion transistors on a chip? And the self-driving car challenge was actually a DARPA challenge that everyone failed the first year. And nobody collected the prize. And so there are a whole bunch of patterns that have come out of 60 or 70 years worth of doing this that people haven't really studied. And that's why I really said, I'm going to have to become a student of this. And what if we could, and I reached out to the head of DARPA at the time under the Obama administration, Aarti Prabhakar, who's just amazing. And she really was, in my mind, one of the most recent DARPA directors and she's back in the Biden administration now as a cabinet level position for science and tech. And I said, what could you never do because you were actually shaped by national security? You know, you were inside of the military. Your service was to protect democracy and to protect the way of life of America. What couldn't you do? Like, could we ever build a Department of Strategic Surprise not shaped by national security, but shaped by global existential threats and by business prosperity, like outside of this? And she said, oh my gosh, I wish somebody would do this because, you know, our economy is very different than the other economy. You know, you can build a few joint strike fighters, you know, if it's about national security. And so I started really becoming a student of this. And it turns out you can build muscles in strategic surprise if you're leading an organization. And there are these mechanisms. And one of them is one of the things, and Gil Pratt, who now is at Toyota Research, but he was the program manager for the Grand Autonomous Vehicle Challenge. And he said, one of the things we're trying to do is we try to pick something impossible. And we say, if that ever becomes improbable, that would be bad. And we need to know about it. But if it stays impossible, we can all ignore it, right? Because that's not going to surprise us. If it's like magic levitation or wormholes, and if it's impossible, ignore it. But if something feels, and a program manager would come in and their hair was on fire, they only had one, you know, like two-year tours of duty, and they could see or taste that something might move from impossible to improbable. And they could fund a whole bunch of people. And everyone who was a performer would say, that's impossible, Gil. That's not possible. And he'd be like, I know, but what if it was? And they would try to prototype it. So one part was coming up with a bold, impossible challenge that if it actually became improbable, could actually really be a paradigm change and could change an industry or change a whole economy. The second was build a community of people who can't look back. And so curiously enough, when everyone went to the Grand Challenge, there were like high school and college teams competing. There were major car companies that were building cars from scratch. There were others that were buying like National Instruments boards off the shelf from student projects and like wiring up old Hondas. And everyone lost. And they all wanted to be in the history books. But you could suddenly see what everyone else was doing around the world because it was open to everybody. The next year, two years later, they doubled the prize to $2 million from $1 million to $2. And suddenly, Caltech and Stanford and Carnegie Mellon all suddenly win. And there's the top five. And some people are like, whoa, there's something here. And then like 3 or 4 years later, it's now an urban challenge and they've got like stunt drivers and whatever. And now there's a whole community that can't look back. And in a sense, the government can stop funding it because now there are a whole bunch of people who are going to go out to the Apples of the world or the Waymos of the world, and they're going to try to build this or build autonomous trucks or something, or, you know, drones or whatever.
I really like that idea of sort of thinking about things moving from the impossible to the improbable as a good framing. We do a lot of that within sort of the CAST project at NASA. And one of the things we sort of talk about is sort of how sci-fi can actually help inform us, sort of challenge our preconceived notions. Because I think we discussed that the best sci-fi is not where they change tons of things. It's where they change one thing and you sort of watch and understand the ripple.
And you see, yeah.
And you mentioned sort of the early days of the internet. I mean, I think there's a show, I think wrapping up season 3 now on Apple TV with For All Mankind, where the whole premise of the sci-fi is an alternate future where one guy in Russia, was it Sergei Lorarev, said Leonov, Sergei Leonov, doesn't die. And he's sort of their Vertebron Braun. And it's like, what happens if the Soviet Union doesn't have that? And I think it creates this great hypothetical to sort of explore from a narrative perspective, but doing that from a technology and from a framing and from a planning perspective is, we found very powerful. So it's great to hear that, like, that is, we're not far from the mark here.
Well, and you won't be surprised that science fiction authors are a part of the team. Often.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And they're really to help explore that stuff. So you'll see a David Brennan or a Ted Chiang or a Greg Bear or other science fiction authors, Tim Stanley Robinson, et cetera. And you'll see them actually helping think of speculative futures or design fictions. You know, when a CFO creates a spreadsheet for balancing and thinking about their forecast, we know it's a fiction. It's a financial fiction. Marco has taught me about this in some ways. But how do we create design fiction? And there's now a whole field called design fiction, and it explores speculative futures. You come up with an impossible thing from the future, And there are even card sets that you can use to like play this out. And then you bring it to today and you put it under forced evolution. And I think that's one of the other things that's really important if we think of complex systems. No complex system. Do you have a deck? Okay, wait. James, tell me about what you're holding up.
I'm holding up Oblique Strategies, which is
a challenge.
Yeah, challenge preconceived notions. But yeah, sits on my desk. So
other than a word or two about Oblique Strategies, who created that?
Brian Eno and Peter Schmidt, I think.
So Brian Eno, like most epic musical producer ever, who's legendary for helping musicians you all know and love, like totally reinvent themselves. He came up with these Oblique Strategies, and he had this little list in the 70s, really. And he would pull it out, and it would just be a challenge. And if you read one of these, they're just fascinating. It's like, throw it all away and start again, you know, or if it's really small, make it big or whatever.
I got one. Yeah, do something boring. Yeah. Do something boring is the one.
Yeah, do something boring.
Boy, no.
But you have to kind of come up with a thing from the future. But there's no such thing as a complex system that started as a complex system. They always start as a simple system that loops, that can evolve. And then if you can put it under forced evolution, so at DARPA, they'll call it a war game. But you'll do every 6 weeks, you'll simulate a year in a week, 24 hours a day. And you'll learn about the new way the operation might work, how the generals might play. But you'll also learn how the new technology has to be pulled in. And it'll loop and do forced evolution. And we did this at Autodesk with something called Fusion. It was like a cute little cloud-based design CAD tool. But every 6 weeks, we launched new things in the cloud, and 20% of the features came from the community. So it suddenly, we published the roadmap. Everyone, all the competitors could see it, but we were just like, we're going to go faster. We're going to evolve in it. And now it's got generative AI built into it. It's got economics and embodied carbon built into it for the environment. But it evolved radically differently because it came as this kind of impossible product that people dismissed as a toy. But then it went into forced evolution really fast. And I think that's another thing we can learn.
Absolutely. Mickey, let me just jump in here because there is another aspect of this that I would like to explore with you. And it's the following. I think part of the reason why the concept of strategic surprise strikes people so strongly is that there is it's almost like an oxymoron. You think of surprise as something that comes out of the blue, and strategy is something which is deliberately planned. So my question is, how do we strike the right balance between deliberative planning for different futures with leaving sufficient room for serendipity and therefore unexpected surprise, unplanned surprises, so to speak, and thereby create more possible futures and become better prepared for points in time in the future where we need to pull the plan off the shelf and be ready, have something there that we can pull out and say, hey, this is contingency number 7. This is the plan we have to use. Tell us, how do we go about it?
Well, and that's a big deal, right? You want to have, strategy has multiple dimensions, right? Sometimes strategy is a ploy. Sometimes it's a plan. Sometimes it's a place, a perspective. You know, there are multiple things, but you want to have that. But it's interesting. I've been talking to CEOs around the world, big, high-level CEOs. And in fact, just last week, I was talking to a whole bunch of them that were here for a synthetic biology conference, which, by the way, if you want to see a surprise, wait until AI meets synthetic biology, which it is. And LICE is like showing off all the time about how it manufactures things, right? It's solar-powered, it's self-repairing, it's self-replicating, and if you grind it up, it turns into great fertilizer. So unlike an Apple like iPhone, which is sort of lots of toxic stuff, complicated things, life is showing off. So if you look at this stuff, I asked the CEOs, you've made a whole bunch of commitments for climate or for reducing temperature on the planet or for just living better with the planet, so we have biodiversity. How much of that goal can you reach by 2030 or by 2050? And they tell me, 20% just being transparent and actually reporting on us getting on planes and all that stuff, taking these externalities. We can do 20% just by being transparent and reporting on this stuff to reach our goals. 30% more if we put pressure on our whole value chain, on our supply chain, our partners, if we start adopting interstitial technologies, like technologies we know work in other industries, we just have never adopted them. We can get the other 30%. That gets us 50% of the way there. I said, what about the other 50%? We have no idea. We have no idea how to reach those. That other 50% is strategic surprise. It's going to be emerging things like generative AI meets synthetic biology or other climate tech things like Breakthrough Energy Ventures is working on fusion or working on, you know, pocket fusion reactors. Those things don't exist. And there's no supply chain or ecosystem or value chain to do it. And so I always say, could you invest maybe 5 or 10% in strategic surprise on your strategy and the rest keep doing on your normal approach? And don't just do it in R&D because innovation comes out of all sorts of places in your organization. But 5% for strategic surprise. And if you look at DARPA's budget, it's like a small percentage of the overall defense budget, but it's actually had this incredible return on investment. And I think that's the same corollary I'd look for.
It's a fascinating place to cap our second episode. So in the first episode with you, Mickey, we've discussed the importance of complexity and how complexity is growing. In the second episode, we've discussed how in an increasingly complex world, surprises are everywhere. And we need to have a more deliberate, more strategic approach to being prepared for surprises and being more actively striving to surprise ourselves before we are surprised by others or by the world. And I think this idea of a more active and deliberate approach to creating surprises, which also makes you more resilient to surprises that come out at you from outside, to me, it's the biggest takeaway of today's discussion. James, what are your words of wisdom at the end of this second installment?
I really enjoyed this conversation today. I think the thing that's probably going to stick with me from this conversation is the concept of design fictions. I did not know that even it had emerged as its own discipline. So I guess I have a lot of homework to do is to read into that because that's my jam. I'm gonna dig in. I'll hopefully share what I find with our listeners in the future.
Mickey, any parting shots from you for this second conversation?
Well, I think the other thing is we touched on a little bit in the first episode, but this notion of interdisciplinary or almost anti-disciplinary collaboration, bringing people that think differently than you and that were taught differently and that went to school for different things. And, you know, you as a macroeconomist, you were taught truth is over there. Me as a designer, I was taught truth is some other direction, 90 degrees away. And James, you were taught truth is some other direction. And bringing them all together is really one of the most important parts of strategic surprise. And so I would just caution us to remember that disciplines are totally artificial. You know, they were made for us to kind of slice up this really complex universe and understand it enough that we could grow people and we could have a craft around it. But nature is boundless and overlapping, and we can learn so much by different analogies and making leaps. And often strategic surprise comes from a good innovator making a leap from one discipline to another and seeing a pattern and saying, oh my gosh, wait, what if we did this?
Fantastic. Mickey, thank you very much again. And thanks everybody in the audience for listening to us. And again, stay tuned for episode number 3 of our conversation with Mickey McManus coming soon. Thanks, everybody.